they really aren't.
Thanks very much, Mr. Clark.
Aren't you two forgetting something?
Well, you build in.
Scotland and George. Let's imagine you're sitting on a couch in a humble bungalow in the small North Korean industrial city of Kaengdong, northeast of Pyongyang. It could be anywhere, really. You're gathered around a small screen, watching TV. Shh, American TV.
I thought you were my best friend. This is my sister. My best friend and my sister. I cannot believe this.
Look, we're not just messing around. I love her.
It's true. I love him, too.
My best friend and my sister.
You explain that these folks on the screen are friends. That's the name of the show, in fact, that Monica and Chandler are dating and that Ross is kind of upset. And this is what it's like, sort of, in America. And here, watch this. Here are some desperate housewives, Gabby and Edie. That's the name of that show. They're talking about their husbands, and even someone from North Korea can relate to these folks.
Gabby thinks that Carlos isn't going to find her attractive after he gets his sight back.
Yeah, that was my first thought, too.
Edie?
It's okay. Let her talk. At least she's being honest.
This is the sound and pictures of a very real revolution taking place beyond the CIA's surveillance as North Koreans learn about the outside world through smuggled media. Suddenly they learn the United States and the whole world is not against them.
Yeonmi Park today is a young North Korean defector activist who lives in Seoul. But when she was just a young teenager, she watched for the first time Titanic.
Hold on. Hold on. Keep your eyes closed. Trust me.
I trust you.
Just watching Jack sacrifice his life for Rose, to her, was an incredibly subversive thing to see in a movie. In North Korean movies, people sacrifice their lives for the government. You're supposed to... That is the definition of a hero in North Korea, is that you die for the regime.
I'm flying! Jack!
And the idea that someone could die for love, she told me, was, you know, really eye-opening to her. As silly as it sounds, you know, that's the kind of thing that she said got her thinking for the first time about what might be wrong with North Korea.
It's Andy Greenberg, a senior writer at Wired, who wrote about the highly risky mission of smuggling TV shows and movies from the outside world on little thumb drives into North Korea. It's this month's cover story for Wired magazine.
There is a kind of technological infrastructure in North Korea today. There's no real internet for, you know, hardly anyone. But a lot of people do have these little DVD players. They call them notels. They're these little portable video players that do multiple formats, and they have a battery backup for the frequent blackouts, and they have a USB port, most importantly. So that creates a kind of audience for all of this smuggled content that crosses the border. And USB drives are far superior to the VHS tapes and DVDs that used to be smuggled across. You can conceal them. You could even swallow them if you have to. When the power goes out, they don't get stuck in your DVD player when the cops knock on the door, which is actually an incredibly important factor.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So, in fact, this is like kind of the perfect little device to enable a data smuggling revolution.
And how many can you smuggle at one time? And what kind of sense of the distribution do you have?
The different groups use different methods. You know, some attach packages of hundreds of USB drives to giant balloons that they float across the border. That's in kind of a haphazard way to do it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. The more targeted way is that you arrange these secret meetings lubricated with lots of bribes to border guards at the North Korean-Chinese border. And when you do that, you can easily hand over packages of hundreds or even 1,000 in a package that a data smuggler then carries back across the Tumon or Yalu River border. In other cases, they hide this stuff, probably in smaller quantities, inside of Chinese cargo trucks that are crossing the border as part of the legal trade with, you know, North Korea's neighbor.
Some of the pictures in your article show the river and the march across the river with a little backpack filled with USB drives looks like, you know, Daniel Boone in the
well, it's an incredibly
1700s.
You know, it doesn't look like much. You can't see the guards or the danger there, but it's an incredibly brave thing that these smugglers are doing. Distributing these illegal contents, these things that seem so mundane to us, like Desperate Housewives and Friends, is a crime punishable by death for many people in North Korea. Being caught with the material alone can lead to months or years in these awful slave labor prison camps. I mean, this is serious stuff, and the people who are bringing it to the border, both the defector activists that I spoke to who have left North Korea and the ones who are still in the country enabling this kind of distribution are risking their lives to do it.
Put me into the mind of one of the characters that you met, and how do they see this revolution and how this particular content is actually going to trigger something?
Well, the central character of my story is a guy named Kang Chol-hwan, and he spent, to put him into context, he spent 10 years of his childhood in a prison camp with his entire family for really totally unexplained reasons. And he has this kind of lifelong anger towards the Kim regime. And he sees this as the most powerful thing that he personally can do to overthrow that corrupt and evil government. So he is trying to inspire a kind of Arab Spring uprising, or maybe even more realistically, trying to kind of feed dissent within the Kim power base, maybe the lower level elites who do see the possibility of a better life. You know, he's hoping that this kind of Matrix-style red pill of, you know, outside information can crack that power base and launch a revolution.
Do you have any sense of why he made these choices about the content, what he puts on there, and what he thinks it's going to do to people, to their view of the outside world?
Well, Kang's organization, the North Korean Strategy Center, they actually start the process usually with these focus groups of North Korean defectors. They want to make sure that what they're sending in has impact, that it's not offensive. You know, a lot of people in America got excited about The Interview, this movie that depicts an assassination attempt against Kim Jong-un. North Koreans generally don't like that movie. They find it, you know, offensive. It's too silly. It offends their cultural values, a lot of them say. So you do have to kind of tread lightly with these things. And the North Korean Strategy Center is very careful about choosing things that can kind of, in a very soft power sort of way, show the affluence of the West and South Korea, or the freedom, or simply the small luxuries of our modern life that North Koreans would find radically enlightening.
It was so interesting that one of the people you quoted said that what some of these shows do is provide an argument to the North Korean authorities, who would have the North Koreans believe that we in America are focused almost 24 hours a day on invading North Korea, and that this is our main focus, and that we're trying to bring down the North Korean regime. And one episode of Friends pretty much sends the message that, in fact, Americans aren't terribly concerned about North Korea at all.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. I mean, Kang told me specifically that, you know, an episode of Desperate Housewives, I mean, to us that seems like hardly political material.
No, actually, but it's maybe a bad message to send.
Right, exactly. You wouldn't even think it was a good idea. But to a North Korean, it shows that Americans are just having affairs. They're not plotting the imperial takeover of North Korea. And, you know, they see that Americans have this kind of easy, luxurious lifestyle that they want for themselves. And that kind of plants a seed. And, you know, maybe they start with an episode of Friends, but eventually they might read 1984. And that is a really powerful thing.
What do they think is the tipping point, if there is one? And I hate to use that term, but really, you know, there's a point at which these things could proliferate and then you'll really see some serious feedback.
I asked Kang exactly this question of where is the tipping point. And he said that today perhaps 30% of North Koreans are aware of the outside world, have access to some of this media. When that reaches 50%, he says, that's when they'll start really demanding changes, when the government will have to start making compromises with the populace. Of course, that's very optimistic. But, you know, I asked him then what happens when it reaches 80% or 90%, as it has in the rest of the world where we have access to the internet. And he said that at that point, there's no way the North Korean government in its current form could continue to exist.
Andy Greenberg is senior writer at Wired. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Andy Greenberg's article is the cover story for the April issue of Wired.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.